Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission here, as always, is pretty simple. We take these sometimes challenging, sometimes very uncomfortable historical sources, and we try to put them all into context.
The goal is to give you, the listener, the full picture. We call it informed consent.
Exactly. And today we are doing a really critical deep dive into one of the most foundational and, I think, historically contested areas of early Mormonism. And that is the process by which the Book of Mormon was actually translated.
It's one of those topics where the sources, which have, you know, they've always been available to scholars, they stand in such stark contrast to the story that was taught and visually promoted for more than a century.
And for a lot of people grappling with this, it involves confronting a pretty significant emotional and spiritual investment.
Oh, absolutely. And often it comes with this feeling that they weren't really given the whole truth up front.
That feeling, that discovery of a radically different history later in life, that is precisely what we're trying to address here. We want to be your guide through the evidence so you can clearly see what the historical record says versus what the, let's call it, the institutional narrative has presented.
Right. And our job isn't persuasion. It's just to provide that context.
So we have to start by framing the fundamental contradiction, because it really is the pivot point for this entire conversation.
It is. You can't understand any of the other issues without first getting this part.
Okay, so let's unpack it right from the get-go. What is the central conflict here, based on all the documentation we have?
The central conflict is all about the instrument and the method Joseph Smith used to produce the text. The correlated story, the one that's been imprinted in the minds of generations through, you know, official church art, films, manuals.
The one everyone sees in Sunday school.
That's the one.
Yeah.
It shows Joseph Smith using these large, sometimes enormous silver rim spectacles, the Urim and Thummim.
And he's usually depicted looking very intently at the gold plates, which are open on a table, right? And the scribe is there, ready to write everything down.
Exactly. That visualization, the open plates, the spectacles on his nose, it has this sort of scholarly, almost King James Bible feel to the whole scene. It projects a really powerful image of solemn, traditional scriptural composition.
It creates a specific expectation.
It does. Now, contrast that image with the overwhelming historical reality. And this is confirmed by multiple diverse witnesses, including his wife, his primary scribes, all of them.
And what do they say?
They say Joseph Smith used a small, dark, often described as a chocolate-colored seer stone or a peep stone. This was a common folk magic artifact at the time.
And the method was completely different.
Completely. The method involved him placing the stone into a hat, burying his face deep into the hat's brim to block out all the external light, and then dictating the text to his scribe, who was usually Oliver Cowdery.
So what about the gold plates in this version of the story? What was their role?
Well, this is the kicker. They were functionally irrelevant to the dictation. The historical accounts, they consistently show that the gold plates were often just wrapped up in a cloth or sometimes buried outside in the woods or simply not even present in the room at all.
So even if they were there, they weren't being looked at.
Never. They weren't being used or viewed during the translation. The plates were this historical source document that was, it seems, bypassed entirely by the revelatory mechanism of the stone in the hat.
This is where the contrast becomes. I mean, it's almost comical in a way, but also deeply revealing. The irony here is just striking, especially when you look at modern pop culture.
You're talking about South Park.
I am. We have sources noting that the animated comedy show South Park presented a more historically accurate depiction of the head in a hat method back in 2003.
Which is just astonishing when you think about it. An irreverent cable cartoon used actual historical accounts to depict the translation process accurately in 2003, while the institutional church was still lagging far behind.
And it wasn't just lagging. 2 years after South Park brought the stone in the hat method into the public consciousness, the church produced a movie for its visitor centers.
In 2005.
In 2005. And it still showed Joseph looking at the plates through the spectacles.
And this wasn't just some historical oversight they corrected quickly. I mean, not at all. We have documented cases of official church artwork, even featured in official publications, continuing to depict the spectacles and plate scenario as late as 2021.
That suggests a long-standing pattern, then, your kind of selective presentation.
It's an institutional choice, a choice to propagate a more comforting, visually appealing, and frankly, a demonstrably inaccurate narrative, long after the historical details were well known to scholars and even being, you know, publicly ridiculed by comedians. This resistance to candor is precisely why a deep dive like this is necessary for informed consent.
So our mission here begins by establishing that historical reality. using the words of the people who were actually there.
Right. And when we rely on the testimonies of the three main individuals involved in that core dictation, David Whitmer, Emma Smith, and Martin Harris, we find a narrative that is remarkably consistent.
And what they describe is a very tight, controlled, almost mechanical process.
Exactly. This wasn't Joseph just reading off thoughts or getting some vague, generalized spiritual inspiration. It was portrayed as this high-tech, word-for-word spiritual dictation straight from the divine source onto the stone.
That distinction, word-for-word versus general inspiration, that's really critical because it shapes our understanding of the text's origin and all the later changes. So let's start with David Whitmer, one of the three witnesses. His testimony is essential because he saw the process happening over and over again. What did he say about the exact mechanics of this rock in a hat translation?
Whitmer detailed a process that sounds highly structured, almost automated. He said Jason Smith would place the small seer stone into the hat, then draw the hat tightly around his face to exclude all the external light.
Okay, so it had to be completely dark inside the hat.
Totally dark. And in that complete darkness, a spiritual light would shine, and words would appear on what he described as a piece of material that looked like parchment. And the words appeared one character at a time, or sometimes a full sentence at a time.
So the visual component was internal to the hat. It relied on blocking out the sun, which, as we'll get into, creates some major problems for later apologetic comparisons. What happened after Joseph saw the English translation appear on the stone?
Joseph would then read that dictated English text off to the scribe, usually Oliver Cowdery, who had to write it down. But crucially, the process included a kind of divine quality check, a feedback loop.
The feedback loop, what do you mean?
The scribe had to repeat the words back to Joseph precisely as they were dictated and written. If the words were written down correctly, Whitmer claimed, the sentence would disappear and the next sentence would appear on the stone.
And if they weren't?
If the scribe made an error, the words remained until corrected.
Wow. That is an incredibly specific and significant detail. It suggests the process wasn't just dictation, but essentially a divine spell checker and grammar checker built right into the mechanism.
That's what it implies, that the stone itself was sensitive enough to detect sound, compare the dictated phrase with what was written, and then refuse to advance the revelation until the transcription was perfect.
So it's the strictest form of what scholars call a tight translation.
Precisely. A tightly controlled word-for-word transcription dictated by the divine source right onto the rock surface, demanding absolute fidelity before the text could move forward. This process seemingly eliminated any possibility of human error or grammatical imperfection in the output.
Okay, let's bring in Emma Smith. Joseph's wife and his very first scribe for that original lost 116 pages of the manuscript.
Right.
Her account has to be invaluable because she was there for that initial, messy, crucial period.
Her account is so powerful. It strongly confirms the core methodology and, maybe more damaging to the traditional narrative, the absolute irrelevance of the plates. She frequently recalled writing day after day, often sitting right next to him.
And her description of the setting.
Her key description confirms the method. She said Joseph was sitting with his face buried in his hat with the stone in it and dictating hour after hour with nothing between us.
Nothing between us. That is unambiguous. It explicitly confirms the head and hat method, and just as importantly, it confirms the physical gold plates were not on the table. They weren't being viewed. They weren't being handled. They weren't functioning as the source document for the English text being produced.
This is why her testimony is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
She even mentioned that she rarely saw the plates at all during this time, and when she did, they were covered up in a cloth in the corner of the room. The mechanism of translation was entirely mediated through the stone, independent of the plate's physical presence.
Then we also have the testimony of Martin Harris, another early scribe, the one who mortgaged his farm to finance the printing. He seems to reinforce this tight nature of the transcription process, aligning perfectly with Whitmer.
He does. Harris confirmed the same visual and mechanical mechanism. He described sentences appearing, being read by the prophet, and then written down. And the crucial confirmation was, again, that self-correction mechanism. If it was written correctly, the sentence would disappear and another would appear. If not, it remained until corrected.
And what was his conclusion about the translation?
Harris concluded that the translation was just as it was engraven on the plates, precisely in the language then used.
So all three key witnesses described this miraculous, word-for-word, divinely proofread process where the plates were functionally unnecessary. All you needed was the rock in the hat. But this is where we hit a major logical paradox.
A huge one.
If the stone was a divine spell checker and grammar checker that insisted on literal perfection before the text would advance, why did the resulting Book of Mormon manuscript require hundreds of thousands of corrections?
This is the historical contradiction that really unravels the tight translation theory. When scholars examine the original 1830 manuscript and the printer's manuscript, they find a text that is just riddled with the characteristics of hastily dictated speech.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it features what you could call deformed English, grammatical inconsistencies, poor punctuation, run-on sentences.
Can you give us some specific examples of the quality of that original dictation?
Absolutely. You see phrases that clearly indicate 19th century dictation trying to sound biblical, but, you know, failing grammatically. You get lines with awkward double negatives or misused conjunctions. A famous early version of a phrase in 1 Nephi was, "After that, I had troubled the space of many hours."
It's just clumsy.
Very clumsy. The structure is often just starting sentences with, "And it came to pass hundreds and hundreds of times," a characteristic you find in the King James Bible style Joseph would have been familiar with, but it's deployed with very little literary grace.
And the edits that were needed weren't just about fixing run-on sentences, were they? They were substantive.
They were massive. The Book of Mormon has undergone well over 100,000 grammatical and spelling changes since that original 1830 edition. But more critically, some of the edits were doctrinal.
Doctrinal how?
Well, the 1830 edition has passages where Jesus Christ is referred to only as God. For instance, 1 Nephi 11.21 originally read, "the God of Israel." This was later changed to, "the Son of God."
That's not a grammatical correction.
Not at all. That is a fundamental clarification of the Godhead. It's a change that was necessary to align the Book of Mormon with the emerging Mormon theological views on the distinct personages of the Father and the Son.
So if the stone literally refused to advance the text until the phrase was written perfectly, as the witnesses all testified, then we're left with two very uncomfortable possibilities.
Right. Either God translated 17th century King James English with grammatical and doctrinal errors directly onto the stone.
Or the tight translation claims of the witnesses were simply inaccurate, and Joseph was using the stone more as a prop for a more traditional process of oral composition, a loose translation.
And the apologetic explanation that Joseph was just dictating a general idea, a loose translation, that directly contradicts the explicit, tight, sentence-by-sentence account of the three main witnesses, it creates a paradox with no clean faith-promoting resolution.
The historical evidence of the translation method and the textual evidence of the resulting manuscript are just incompatible.
They are. And this failure of perfection leads us right to the stone's origin. Because if it wasn't a perfect, divine, revelatory device, what was it originally used for?
Right. To understand the function of the stone, we have to place Joseph Smith in his context. We're talking about 19th century upstate New York, which was absolutely steeped in folk magic, spirituality, and critically treasure-seeking.
And this is the crucial link the church minimized for decades. The instrument of scripture was not a new creation. The seer stone, that small brown or chocolate-colored rock used in the hat, was the same rock that he used for treasure digging. It had a history long before it had a scriptural purpose.
So how did he get this specific stone? And what was his reputation in the community before 1827, before the Book of Mormon story starts?
Joseph Smith found this stone sometime around 1822 or 1823. He was digging a well for a neighbor named Willard Chase, and he became known throughout the region, New York and Pennsylvania, for engaging in glass-looking or peeping.
Which was what exactly?
It was a widespread folk tradition of using a specialized stone to locate buried treasure or lost objects or even find water. And his legal history confirms this. He faced legal charges, including an 1826 trial in South Bainbridge, New York, for being a disorderly person and engaging in glass-looking, essentially fraudulent money digging.
So when he eventually transitioned from seeking Spanish gold to dictating ancient scripture,
he used the exact same tool and the exact same methodology.
Okay, so let's compare them side by side. The translation methodology, hat over face, looking for spiritual light, how does that stack up against the firsthand accounts of his treasure-seeking activities?
The comparison is overwhelming. It demonstrates a functional continuity between the two activities. Just consider the account of Joseph Capron, who witnessed Smith's treasure digging firsthand.
What does he report?
Capron said that Joseph claimed to possess supernatural power through a stone of peculiar quality, which he would place in a hat in such a manner to exclude all light except that which emanated from the stone itself.
That sounds familiar.
And Capron concluded this method enabled him to see anything he wished. That detailed description is virtually identical to what David Whitmer and Emma Smith described for the translation of the Book of Mormon. The hat, the exclusion of light, the vision coming from the stone itself.
It's the exact same process.
It is the precise methodology. And then you have the testimony of William Stafford, who was involved in a failed money dig on his own farm with the Smith family. Stafford noted that Joseph Jr. could see hidden things by placing a stone of singular appearance in his hat in such a manner as to exclude all light, at which time they pretended he could see all things within and under the earth. Large gold bars and silver plates.
Wow. Silver plates. Stafford specifically says Joseph claimed to see silver plates using this exact same stone and hat method long before the Book of Mormon translation even began.
The conclusion is, I think, unavoidable. Joseph Smith used treasure digging techniques to obtain the plates, and the exact same techniques using the exact same folk magic stone to translate them. There was no divine upgrade or, you know, graduation in the method.
So the critical implication is that the practice establishes this undeniable link between the supernatural communication for the Book of Mormon and the contemporary, often discredited folk magic tradition of treasure seeking.
That's it. And if the treasure digging consistently failed to produce any treasure, which it did, and it led to accusations of fraud, well, the listener has to ask why the use of the identical method with the identical instrument should suddenly be considered divine revelation. The burden of proof shifts significantly here.
This continuity, which the institution tried to hide for so long by promoting the spectacles narrative, suggests the translation was just another, maybe more successful, application of a long-established local folk practice.
That is the logical consequence of the historical record. The seer stone wasn't some holy relic. It was a regional tool of divination.
So we come back now to the logical problem that this historical method creates. If a translation involved placing a seer stone in a hat, burying your face to exclude light, and dictating English words that appeared on the stone words that were transcribed independently of the actual physical record, then we arrive at the primary functional flaw. Why were the physical gold plates necessary in the first place?
This is often called the smoking gun of the translation narrative, because the complexity of the plates' origin story stands in direct contradiction to their functional irrelevance during the actual translation.
The story itself is incredible.
It is. The plates were the ultimate tangible source. Supposedly engraved on metal, carried thousands of miles, maybe from Mesoamerica to New York, protected by an angel, buried for 1,400 years, retrieved by Joseph after this epic spiritual struggle.
And for all that incredible effort and supernatural preservation.
They were consistently wrapped in a cloth or left in another room during the dictation.
So the core of the problem is structural redundancy. What was the purpose of the entire complicated, miraculous backstory if the source material, the physical plates themselves, was functionally irrelevant to the actual output of the English text?
The plates served one primary purpose, establishing credibility for the source of the records. It linked the text to an ancient civilization and a divine preservation effort. But once you understand that the translation method bypassed the physical source entirely, revealing words directly on a stone, the plates become functionally redundant.
They're an inert prop in the dictation process.
Their only function was narrative, not mechanical.
And this problem is compounded when you consider the sheer physical implausibility of the plates, just based on the Book of Mormon's length. Apologists have tried to prove the possibility of metal plates by citing historical parallels, like the Pyrgi tablets.
Right, but that comparison often backfires spectacularly.
How so? What are the Pyrgi tablets?
They're a set of ancient copper scrolls discovered in India. Some early apologists cited them as evidence that ancient peoples did write long religious narratives on metal plates.
Yeah.
But when you look at the physical dimensions and the word count they contain, they actually demonstrate exactly why the Book of Mormon plates, as they're described, couldn't have worked.
Okay, so how does the math break down?
Well, the Pyrgi tablets could only hold a tiny amount of text, around 67 words each, given the dimensions and inscription techniques. The Book of Mormon, on the other hand, contains approximately 273,725 words.
That's a lot of words.
A huge amount. So if we assume the plates were made of gold, which is incredibly dense, and we use the dimensions Joseph Smith provided, a stack 6 inches thick, about 8 inches long, 6 inches wide, the weight becomes astronomical.
So what are we talking about weight-wise?
Based on the density of gold, even if you allow for the plates being an alloy or having a lot of airspace, the consensus among many physicists is that the stack would have weighed, conservatively, between 150 and 200 pounds. Some estimates push it even higher.
Which makes the stories of him running through the woods with them
completely nonsensical. The anecdotal stories of Joseph Smith fighting off attackers while sprinting through the woods with the plates tucked under his arm, it's just not possible. It would be heavier than Thor's hammer, an impossible weight for a single man to carry casually, let alone run with.
And we also have the visual evidence from the characters copied by Oliver Cowdery, the ones Martin Harris took to Professor Anthon. If we assume the compression rate implied by that material,
which is an extreme compression where two of these copied characters supposedly represented four words of English, even with that, which strains credibility, the sheer volume of text, 273,000 words, would necessitate a stack of plates far larger than the dimensions described.
The internal record keeping would have resulted in an enormous artifact.
Enormous. Perhaps as tall as the trees he's running through, as one analysis suggested. The physicality of the plates just defies all common sense and historical context. The very object intended to be the ultimate tangible proof is, ironically, the most logically and physically implausible aspect of the entire story.
So let's pivot to the terminology. Since the stone in the hat was the real tool, where did this idea of the Urim and Thummim, the spectacles, come from, and why was it promoted so heavily?
The term Urim and Thummim was a later intentional introduction. It was a historical retrofitting of a familiar biblical term onto the folk magic treasure stone to sanitize its origins.
So it wasn't there from the beginning?
Not at all. Joseph Smith initially referred to the revelatory instruments in various ways: interpreters, spectacles, or stones. The specific phrase Urim and Thummim didn't exist in the early translation narrative until W.W. Phelps introduced it around 1832 or 1833.
Years after the translation was basically complete.
Correct. And the historical record shows that early revelations were later altered to explicitly insert the term. For example, some early drafts of what became the Doctrine and Covenants used the term interpreters, which were later changed to Urim and Thummim.
So that's demonstrable evidence of historical manipulation.
It is. It was designed to give the process a greater biblical pedigree.
And if we look at the actual biblical definition of the Urim and Thummim, does that comparison even hold up?
Not in the slightest. The biblical Urim and Thummim were highly restricted in function. They were used by the high priests to get binary answers, essentially limited to yes or no responses or clear divine affirmation. They were not instruments for complex long-form translation, giving detailed visions, or locating buried objects.
All the things Joseph Smith needed them for.
Exactly. So the institutional choice was to take this term associated with binary high priestly revelation and apply it to a folk magic stone used for complex dictation and treasure hunting.
It's an act of institutional ambiguity.
It is. Using a well-known, prestigious biblical term to give the historically questionable treasure stone more credibility. It's an attempt to replace a problematic local artifact with a sanitized, sacred biblical concept, even though the functions of the two instruments are utterly incompatible.
So the evidence continues to mount when we examine the text itself. The translation process and the resulting Book of Mormon seems to bear these clear, distinct fingerprints that trace its origin directly to 19th century upstate New York, not ancient Mesoamerica.
Oh, absolutely. We see this in the supposed ancient language on the plates, the revision of history around key figures, and, crucially, in Joseph Smith's own demonstrable capacity for authorship.
Let's start with that language, Reformed Egyptian. The characters Joseph supposedly copied before the 116 Lost Pages incident. Martin Harris took a copy of these characters, the Anthon transcript, to Professor Charles Anthon. What does modern linguistic analysis tell us about those characters?
Well, the characters that Joseph copied have been analyzed not as actual Egyptian or any known ancient language, but as crudely modified English. This observation was powerfully demonstrated by researchers like the Tanners.
Deformed English. What does that actually look like?
If you look closely at the surviving copies of the Anthon transcript, you see visual elements that resemble familiar symbols, just turned or twisted. For instance, you can find shapes that look like the capital English letters C, M, and A, or the numerals 2 and 4, but with extra lines, dashes, or curls added to make them seem esoteric or foreign.
So it looks like someone trying to invent a language.
That's what it looks like. The Tanners were actually able to create a functional font by simply rotating, curving, and modifying elements found in that character sheet to write a message in English.
That visual correlation is incredibly powerful. It suggests composition through modification rather than the transcription of a true ancient script, which raises the question, why is the institutional church so hesitant to show the original Anthon transcript?
They're highly selective about it. In modern apologetic videos, like the Now You Know series, which are meant for a broader audience, the church often avoids displaying the actual original Anthon transcript characters.
What do they show instead?
They display invented, more complex, and genuinely Egyptian-looking characters that have no historical link to Joseph Smith's earliest copies. This strategic omission suggests they're aware the original copy is visually difficult to defend. It wouldn't withstand even basic visual inspection by a skeptical viewer.
And moving to the process of history revision, you mentioned that the account of Martin Harris's visit to Charles Anthon was altered after Harris later left the church.
Right, and this alteration highlights how early accounts were selectively edited to maximize faith-promoting outcomes. A crucial piece of text was added later to the history of that visit, specifically the mention of the sealed part of the plates, which Anthon supposedly refused to translate.
And why was that detail so important to add?
It was added specifically to fulfill a prophecy found in Isaiah, which spoke of a sealed book coming forth.
So the narrative was adapted after the fact to make sure it aligned perfectly with scriptural expectations.
Precisely. It's a textbook example of backdating prophecy. By editing the historical account to include the sealed portion, Joseph could claim that the events surrounding the Book of Mormon's emergence were directly foreshadowed and guaranteed by the Old Testament, which would bolster its legitimacy regardless of what actually happened during the visit itself.
So this brings us to the final major apologetic we have to address. The claim that Joseph was simply too uneducated to write a book of this magnitude. The church has often portrayed him as this uneducated farm boy who could neither write nor dictate a coherent and well-worded letter. This is the foundational impossibility argument.
And it's a significant misrepresentation of Joseph Smith's true capacity. It's designed to lower the bar of his ability so that the book's existence seems miraculous by comparison.
And he wasn't illiterate.
Far from it. While he lacked a formal classical education, Joseph was not illiterate. If you examine his actual writing, like his 1829 letter to Oliver Cowdery, he was perfectly capable of writing a well-composed, coherent, and forceful letter. His vocabulary and sentence structure demonstrate a clear capacity for literary composition.
And beyond just basic literacy, we have that powerful testimony from his mother, Lucy Mack Smith, confirming his capacity as a gifted oral storyteller. This seems crucial because the Book of Mormon was created through oral dictation, not written composition.
This is perhaps the most overlooked piece of evidence demonstrating his capacity as the author or dictator. Lucy Mack Smith testified that Joseph was indeed a gifted storyteller. She said he could describe the ancient inhabitants, their culture, their religion, their warfare, with as much ease seemingly as if he had spent his whole life among them, often keeping his family spellbound for hours.
And this was happening before the translation began.
Years before. He was essentially practicing the Book of Mormon's job, orally dictating its themes and narratives for entertainment and discussion right there in his own home.
This preparation is key. And it ties directly back to the timeline analysis. Apologists often claim the 90-day timeline for dictation makes spontaneous composition impossible, requiring divine aid. But if we actually run the numbers on that, what does the math say?
The math systematically refutes the claim of impossibility. The Book of Mormon is about 273,725 words long. If we use a rough and probably generous estimate of 85 dictation days to account for breaks and interruptions, which is the typical time frame, this required Joseph to dictate approximately 3,200 words per day.
Which still sounds like a significant output for a 19th century individual.
It is, but it's entirely manageable, especially for oral dictation. Research shows that the average dictation rate for clean, legible text is about 1,200 words per hour. Therefore, dictating 3,200 words required only about 2 hours and 40 minutes of actual focused dictation per day.
2 hours and 40 minutes. That is a highly manageable workflow. It leaves the vast majority of the day upwards of 10 to 12 hours for other things, breaks, socializing, farming.
And, crucially, planning the next sections of the narrative. And this is where the research on evangelical preaching techniques becomes relevant. Joseph didn't necessarily need to compose every line fresh on the spot. He could use the talking in heads method, a recognized oral outlining technique used by contemporary evangelical preachers.
So he could have had a mental outline.
Exactly. It would have allowed him to organize major narrative arcs, character shifts, and theological points mentally. Essentially, he'd have a bullet point outline in his head, which he could then fill in with that familiar Bible-mimicking language during the actual dictation sessions.
So the timeline isn't evidence of a miracle. It's evidence of an achievable composition rate made possible by years of mental preparation, extensive oral practice, and a surprisingly short, controlled daily workflow.
The conclusion is firm. The Book of Mormon is a literary time capsule of Joseph Smith's time and place. It reflects his father's prophetic dream, the Tree of Life, his involvement in treasure-digging themes, and the specific Protestant revivalist influences of his environment. The narrative is so specific to his experiences in oral capacity that it is highly plausible that, as some have said, nobody else but him could have written it.
So this extensive body of historical evidence brings us right back to the central issue. The decades-long institutional choice to promote the skeptical's and plates narrative while minimizing or ignoring the history of the seer stone in the hat. This is the core issue of candor and informed consent.
And we have to acknowledge that the institution's presentation of its history was, for decades, characterized by selective memory, or, let's say, institutional ambiguity. They chose to promote the visually compelling story over the historically verifiable one.
We mentioned Richard Bushman earlier, the prominent believing historian. He openly criticized the institutional resistance to updating the art and the teaching.
His criticism was pointed, because he and other believing scholars had known the full truth about the Seer Stone since the 1960s. He publicly stated that the continued use of old artwork showing the plates is irksome, and that it feeds into the notion that the church is trying to cover up embarrassing episodes and just sort of prettifying its own history.
He essentially urged them to stop the practice immediately.
He did, because he knew it created a trust deficit when members inevitably discovered the full history on their own.
The delay in acknowledging their history, coupled with the slow, phased release of information, suggests a strategic approach, which critics have often labeled the inoculation strategy.
And that strategy is highly calculated. It involves releasing limited, carefully sanitized information, often tucked away in highly specialized resources like the Gospel Topics essays on the church website or the multi-volume Saints History book.
The idea being to provide just enough information.
Exactly. So that when a faithful member inevitably encounters the full, challenging historical truth like the failed treasure diving or issues with polygamy, they've already been inoculated. They can say, oh, I already heard a brief mention of the Seer Stone, so it's not a big deal. But the most difficult details are buried so deep that most members will never encounter them unless they're already in a crisis of faith and actively searching.
And when the church does publicly address the Seer Stone today, they often try to normalize the folk magic method through flawed logical analogies, which just leads to more confusion. Let's dissect two key examples, starting with a comparison made by Brad Wilcox, a higher-ranking youth leader and BYU professor. He compared the Seer Stone to a cell phone.
The cell phone analogy is it's intellectually dishonest. It attempts to impose modern functionality onto a 19th century folk artifact. Wilcox argued that Joseph put the stone in the hat merely to block out light, similar to shading an iPhone screen on a sunny day.
And that fails on multiple levels.
Multiple levels. First, Joseph was translating indoors, often in poorly lit 19th century farmhouses. The hat was not a sunshield. Second, the hat was arguably necessary to protect the stone's source of charisma, or to obscure the fact that the stone might not have been producing a translation visually lay, maintaining the illusion or the ritual of divination.
You can't honestly compare a folk magic stone tied to fraudulent financial practices with a universally proven, mass-produced modern device.
You can't. And a similar argument was made in an official Now You Know video, which compared the Seer Stone to Moses' staff or Jesus using mud to heal the blind, suggesting that God just uses familiar, mundane objects.
And that comparison is equally flawed.
It is, because it ignores the crucial context of the stone's pre-scriptural history. Moses' staff and the mud Jesus used were not instruments they used repeatedly for private financial gain or that were involved in local legal accusations of fraud. They were tools used for specific public divine purposes.
But Joseph Smith's Seer Stone has this undeniable link to decades of failed treasure-seeking activity.
And that's the difference. The comparison attempts to use biblical prestige to whitewash and sanitize a historically questionable artifact that had a history of failure and legal trouble.
So the core consequence of this ongoing pattern of historical avoidance and deceptive apologetic analogies is the erosion of trust.
Absolutely. The lack of candor has significant consequences. This is the Watergate principle. The cover-up is often worse than the crime. The pain, the isolation, the familial fractures that believers experience when they discover this history later in life, It often stems not from the historical fact of the seer stone itself, but from the institutional feeling that the organization intentionally withheld or distorted information they needed to make an honest, lifelong commitment. It's a fundamental lack of informed consent.
So this entire deep dive has been focused on separating that compelling narrative from the verifiable historical record. We've seen that the evidence strongly suggests the plates were functionally redundant, the method was identical to treasure digging, and the text itself required extensive editing, contradicting those tight translation claims.
And if you look at the choices made by the institution, prioritizing a clean, faith-promoting story over the uncomfortable historical reality, it raises a necessary question. Richard Bushman, in his attempt to temper his earlier critique, raised the point that if the church abandoned the plates entirely, it would lose the powerful form of the evidence and gut some of the most gritty and appealing parts of the Mormon story.
He was arguing, in essence, that the aesthetic, the narrative value of the plates was still worth preserving, even if the method bypassed them.
Yes. And that raises the essential, provocative question for you, the listener, who is now well informed about the history. If the historical evidence is demonstrably uncomfortable, is a compelling, faith-promoting story more valuable or more necessary than uncomfortable, difficult historical integrity?
And when you look back at your own initial commitment, how does the realization that the narrative was selectively presented impact your personal threshold for historical integrity?
That's the question.
That is a powerful question to end on, one that addresses the heart of what informed consent truly means. If you have been wrestling with the historical reality of the seer stone in the hat, the logical flaws of the gold plates, or the institutional response to this history, we hope this deep dive provided the objective context you need to move forward. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.